But James goes on to say that another evidence of true saving faith is that a person who knows Christ and has been transformed by his salvation and his grace prefers God's will over against his own. So point number 20 is God prefers God's will. The way he says that is in James chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. Listen to this as I read. "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit." You think, when I read that, I think, I talk like that all the time. What's the problem? I don't get it. I mean, all the guy's doing is making a plan. How many of you have a day planner? What are you going to do tomorrow? See, you already know. Or at least you think you do. See, we all make plans. Is God opposed to plans? No. But what is conspicuously absent in these plans is God. Where does God fit into this? Now, when we say that a believer prefers God's will, there's two wills that we often think about when we talk about God's will. There's his providential will or his sovereign will, which he has already ordained from eternity past, and it's going to come and it's going to take place, period. And we don't know what that is. God has given us general ideas about how things turn out. We win, the devil loses, etc. So there are broad brushstrokes of God's sovereign will that he gives us glimpses into, but the daily details, he just doesn't give us those, he doesn't give us access to those. And when you finally have access to the daily details of what God's providential will is, it's already happened. You just go look back and you go, well, that was God's providential will. When I talk about God's providential will, what I'm saying is this, that even the Christian prefers God's providential will over his own. But there's another kind of will that we think about when we're talking about God's will, and that is God's moral will that has to do with our character. Are we honest? Are we faithful? Dependable? Are we pure? Are we righteous? Are we holy? Do we steal? Do we covet? Do we lust? Etc. That's God's moral will. And God's moral will, get this, is the same for everybody. But his providential will is as varied as you are from one another. It is unique, it is detailed, and it is something that he does not give you access to. And when we read these words in verse 13, we're going to go to such and such a place, spend a year there, and engage in business, and make a profit. We're talking about God's providential will, not his moral will. There's certainly within God's moral will to make a profit. God doesn't despise that at all. The New Testament and the Old Testament's clear about making profit. It is a good thing as long as it's done within his moral will, ethically. So he's not upset with them for the idea that they're going to make a profit. He's upset with them because they will not submit their plans to God. They're being presumptuous. They're going headlong into their day or their week or their year planning without submitting their plans to plan check. How many of you have ever built a house? You know what it's like to have to submit your plans to plan check. Sometimes they never come out. And when they do, they've been altered. And you think, what's going on here? And you finally get the house built and you think, well, I never want to do that again because I had to submit all these plans to the county and so on and so forth. God is saying, when you make plans for your day, I want you to submit your plans to me. Now, the words themselves are not a problem. Verse 13, we're going to go to this place, we're going to spend a year there, we're going to make a profit. Everybody plans that way. You should plan that way. So the idea that they want to make a plan is not a problem. So we have God's moral will and we have his providential will. His providential will is something you can't know until after it happens. His moral will is something you can know right now. It's revealed in his word very clearly. And you can follow it today, tomorrow, and the rest of your life, as long as God gives you breath. You can follow his moral will. In fact, he commands you to follow his moral will. But when it comes to his providential will, we need to have a disposition and an attitude that says, Lord, whatever you want is what I want. I know what I want, but I know that I want what you want more than what I want. And if what I want isn't consistent with what you want, I want you what you want. I remember when my dad had a stroke and we got to Texas and we went to the hospital to visit and he was unconscious. And the stroke was pretty severe and they weren't sure whether he was going to live. And if he did live, would he be healthy? Would he be able to know us? Would he be able to talk? Would he be able to see, etc.? And I remember every night going home after being in the hospital all day and praying to God, God, let my dad live. In fact, give him 15 more years. I remembered that in the Bible, you know, give him 15 more years. And then I would say, but not my will be done, but your will be done. And you know what? It was God's will to let him die. It wasn't God's will to let him live. And then on the other side of that, I'm okay. I was okay with it on the front side of it too. But I'm okay even more so now because my dad is with the Lord. And it's far better, Paul says, to be with the Lord, to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. And so God's will is far better than what I requested. But it didn't stop me from asking him what I wanted. This is what I want, God. I want my dad to live. And I want to be with him for more years of my life and my grandkids to be with him for more years of their life. And I want you to let him live. In fact, I want you to give him 15 years. Now, my dad may have said, well, why'd you stop with 15? You know, you should have just said 20. You know, but that's what I wanted, and I prayed it. But I qualified my prayer, whatever you want, Lord. That's what I think is best. And Jesus taught us to pray in Matthew 6:10 when the disciples asked him, how should we pray? He said, this is the way you ought to pray. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Right? What's the first petition? Hallowed be my name. No. Hallowed be thy name. We've already got the right perspective. From the start of the prayer, it's all about God. It's all about him. And one of the signs of saving faith is that it's all about God. One of the signs of dead faith, demon faith, faith that doesn't save, is that it isn't all about God. It's all about somebody else. It's all about me. It's about my success. It's about this, that, and the other thing. See, it's a shift. It's a paradigm shift. See, before you came to Christ, it was all about you. And now that you've come to Christ, it's all about him. Has that shift taken place in your life? Or is it still all about you? You see, if it's still all about you, you need to be concerned. Because Christ calls us to live a life of daily sacrifice. We sacrifice ourselves for him. And we sacrifice ourselves for others. And he says, I'll take care of you if you do what I say. You don't worry about you. I'll worry about you. You worry about loving me with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength. And loving your neighbor as yourself. So what happens to the Christian is, the paradigm shift is, he goes from being self-absorbed to being God-absorbed. He goes from being self-absorbed to being absorbed with others. All the attention goes out and not in. And when you do that, God gives all the attention you need to you. That's the way he works. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. But you seek yourself first. You seek your own ambitions first, and you'll be last. That's God's economy. That's the way he works. He says, he who seeks to save his own life will lose it. But he who loses his life for my sake will find it. When you put God first, you put others first, He puts you first. You put you first, God puts you last. So Jesus says, hallowed be your name. And then the next petition, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. There's that paradigm shift again. It isn't about me anymore. It's about God. God, what you want. Is that your prayer today? Does that characterize your attitude as you walk throughout the day, the week, the years? Is that something that could be said on your tombstone? He cared more about God's will than his own. Say, well, it's easy for Jesus to say he was God. I mean, you know, he wants, of course he wants his will to be done. I want my will to be done too. That's not a hard prayer to pray. Yeah, but try it this way. When Jesus is just about to be crucified and he knows that he's going to go to the cross and he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray and he says, Lord, if there's any way for this cup to pass from me, let it be so. You know what he was wanting to pass? Not the nails, not the spear, not the beating, not the plucking of his beard, not the scorn, not the abandonment, not the rejection. It wasn't any of those things that he was wanting the cup to pass from him. It was that he was going to bear the sins of the world that he had never borne ever before, and God was going to turn his face away from the Son for the very first time in eternity. And Jesus would utter the words, Eloi, 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 lama sabachthani, my God, my God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And Jesus prayed that that cup be removed. And then he said, but nevertheless, not my will be done, but thy will be done. Do you really believe that God's will is better than yours? Jesus did. In John 4:34, Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. In James chapter 4, verse 13, they say, we are going to go to a certain city. We are going to spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. James says in verse 14, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. I love the four seasons, don't you? But I like some more than others. And I wasn't expecting what's out there this time of year because I was ready. We had our tomato plants out, right? Hardy tomato plants, nice, healthy. And on Saturday, we go out to look at our plants and they're like this. It's a little too cold on Friday night. The seasons are pointers to the brevity of life. Spring is my favorite time, and summer's second, and fall's third, and winter's last. Anybody agree with me? All right, good. See, you're smart. Okay. But listen to the way it works. Spring is new birth. Life, everything's coming up. It's vibrant, it's fresh, it's new. And then summer, you're at the peak of your life and you have all your energy. You have a little bit of wisdom and a lot of strength. And then fall sets in and things become and start to become dormant. And then winter comes and from our perspective, everything is dead. That's life. And life is so short that life itself, a full life, seems as short as four seasons. You could shrink this down to even a day we love. I love the morning as the sun rises over the horizon and sets in the sky, and it's new and it's fresh and it's pleasant and it's brisk outside, and it just everything's starting to happen. And then the sun sets about the 10 o'clock sky, and you're thinking, this is just great. And then it's at high noon, and you're at the peak of your life. And then it begins to go down. Things begin to shut down, and then it goes down over the horizon, and it's dark. Life happens to us just that quickly. You have no idea what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Verse 15, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. I remember when this verse first was impressed upon my mind, you know, I'd read it many times, but there's a point sometimes when you've read the same thing over and over again, and all of a sudden God takes it and goes, whop, you know. And you go, wow, I've read that 100 times. And all of a sudden, God brought me up short with that verse. And from that point on, I've qualified my comments with, if the Lord wills. Now, I don't always articulate it, or I don't always verbalize it, but it's there. The Lord wills, if the Lord wills, if the Lord wills. So much so that now, if somebody asks me, how are you doing? I say, I think I'm okay. And what do I mean by that? Well, I don't know what tomorrow holds. I don't know what the next hour holds. I don't know what the next day holds. I think I'm okay, because in 30 minutes, I might not be. In an hour, I may not be. In a day, I may not be. And it all comes back to this James 4:15. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or do that. Now, that's not very popular with the name it and claim it crowd. Do you understand? The name it and claim it crowd thinks that if you qualify your prayers with, if the Lord wills, that's a sign of what? Lack of faith. Come on, don't you? I mean, you got to claim it. You got to name it. And then you got to claim it, because God's going to do it. And all that has to take place is you got to make sure that it happens by your faith. And if you start using these Casper Milk Toast, Mealy Mouth, Mamby Pamby qualifiers like, if the Lord wills, well, then you just don't have enough faith. And you can sure bet that your prayer is not going to be answered, because God's not going to answer your prayer if you don't have any faith. And the Lord wills. Of course the Lord wills. You claimed it, didn't you? Baloney. You can't make God do anything that He is not inclined to do. You better say, if the Lord wills, because you don't know what tomorrow holds. You don't know what the next hour holds. He says, but it is as it is, verse 16, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. How are they boasting? Well, you don't hear it in the words. So James must be aware of their attitude, the attitude of their heart. There's this cavalier, sort of carefree attitude about, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And boy, and this is going to happen. And James says, wait a minute. You're living as though life were your own. You're living as though you belong to yourself. You belong to God. He not only has the hairs on your head numbered, He has the days of your life numbered. You're acting presumptuously. Go ahead and make your plans. We all must do that, but submit them to God. Jesus said in John 5:30, I can do nothing of my own initiative. It would be that we had that attitude. Sometimes we have too much initiative. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of Him who sent me. Paul said in Acts chapter 18, verse 20, when they asked him to stay for a longer time, he did not consent, but taking leave of them and saying, I will return to you again if God wills. In Romans 1:10, he says, always in my prayers I make request, if perhaps now at last by the will of God I may succeed in coming to you. In 1 Corinthians 4:19, he said, but I will come to you soon if the Lord wills. He's an apostle. If there's anybody that could name it and claim it, it should have been Paul. But Paul qualifies all of his plans, his itinerary, with the if the Lord wills. You think he might have had some insight into the future? Yes. But he didn't presume on God ever. In 1 Corinthians 16:7, for I do not wish to see you now just in passing, for I hope to remain with you for some time, if the Lord permits. Now I just ask you this question. I've asked you already. I'm going to keep asking it. Do you really believe God's will is better than yours? Let me tell you that the contentment, the secret to contentment, is found right there. The secret to contentment is found in believing that God's will is better than yours. Now, I prayed that my dad would live, and he didn't. I wanted my dad to live, and he didn't. So it isn't saying that you think that God's plan is better than your plan until you know that God's plan is better than your plan. No, it's the attitude of the heart. It's the attitude of looking back on your life and seeing what God has done already and knowing that every stage along the way, what God had willed was better for me than what I had willed. And it's the confidence of seeing what God has done in the past that gives you the ability to say, I know he's going to be good in the future. Will it be easy? No. Will it be difficult? Most definitely. Will it be sometimes discomforting? Yes. Will it be good? Yes. This afternoon, if the Lord wills, we're going to go see the Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian, if the Lord wills. One of my favorite lines in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is when Lucy wants to see Aslan. Aslan is the lion who represents Christ. Fierce, intense, strong, powerful. Lucy is a little bit afraid of Aslan because of his roar, which she should be, right? And she says, is he safe? To which the reply comes, no. He is not safe, but he is good. God's will is never safe. Jesus said it would cost you your life. You cannot be my disciple if you do not take up your cross daily, deny yourself, and follow me. You can know this, that following Christ will cost you. Following Christ will be hard and difficult and treacherous and dangerous, and it won't be safe. But it's good. And I would rather take danger along with goodness any day than to take safety along with evil. Do you believe that God's will is better than your own? Spurgeon said this, when you and I begin to be familiar with affliction, and to thank God for it, we are pretty nearly getting through it. I believe myself that there is a period often set to the sorrow of saints, and that the period is usually coincident with their perfect acquiescence in them. When they are content to have all things as God wills, God will be content to let them have it much as they will. When two wills run together, our will and God's will, then we shall find a sweet double stream of silver peace flowing throughout the rest of our lives. Therefore, let us come to this, even if the very hairs of our head are all numbered, if everything really be ordained of the Most High concerning His people, let us rejoice in the divine appointment and take it as it comes and praise His name, whether our allotment be rough or smooth, bitter or sweet. Let us cheerfully say, if the Lord wills it, and we will it. If He hath purposed it, even so let it be. Since all things work together for the good of those that love God, even to them that are called according to His purpose. James says in chapter 4, verse 14, you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. You don't know what tomorrow holds. John Gill, a Baptist theologian, said whether there would be a morrow for them or not, whether they should live till tomorrow, and if they should, they knew not what a morrow would bring forth or what things would happen, which might prevent their intended journey and success. No man can secure a day, an hour, a moment, and much less a year of continuance in this life. Nor can he foresee what will befall him today or tomorrow. Therefore, it is great stupidity to determine on this and the other without the leave of God in whom he lives, moves, and has his being, and by whose providence all events are governed and directed. I'm sure that the Chapman family didn't expect that they would lose their little girl in a tragic accident. They had no idea what tomorrow held, and tomorrow held something very grievous for them. Stephen Curtis Chapman, in case you didn't know, lost his daughter this last week. Psalms 90, verse 3 says, you turn back man into dust and say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You have swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep in the morning. They are like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes and it sprouts anew, and toward evening it fades and withers away. That's the way we are. That's our life. Say, but all they want to do is go to a town and make a profit. I mean, what's the big deal? It's not a problem. That's not the problem. It's their disregard for God. You see, why are they going to this town or that town to make a profit? What does Paul say in 1 Corinthians 10, 30, 31? Everything that you should do what? For the glory of God. You hear God mentioned here? You say, well, they may have thought it. Well, James obviously didn't think they thought it, or he wouldn't have addressed it. You say, well, maybe it's hypothetical. I'm sure it is. But hypothetical becomes reality in a lot of our lives, doesn't it? Here's an assignment for you. Go home, take your day planner, and put "if God wills" beside all your plans. Now, don't do it unless you mean it. If God wills, if God wills, if God wills, if God wills. And then start living your life that way. It gives you a paradigm shift. It's a change in perspective, but it's a healthy one. Because what it does is it causes you to stop and think, why would God want me to make this profit? What would be in God's providence that would allow Him to let me engage in business and stay for a while and make a profit? What would incline God to do that? Well, why does God do all things, children? Children, why did God make you in all things? For His own glory. Well, why do you think He'd let you make a profit? For His own glory. You see, God is interested in His glory, so we're going to do this thing and we're going to accomplish this thing as long as God gets glorified by it, and that changes everything. Piper said this, God created us not to do things, just do things and go places with our bodies, but to have a certain attitudes and convictions and verbal descriptions that reflect the truth, a true view of life in God. God means for the truth about himself and about life to be known and felt and spoken as part of our reason for being. You weren't just created to go to Denver and do business. You were made to go to Denver with thoughts and attitudes and words that reflect a right view of life in God. Psalm 102, 11 and 12. My days are like a lengthened shadow, and I wither away like grass. But you, O Lord, abide forever, and your name to all generations. John Gill said, wicked and atheistic as expressing a neglect and an independence of on providence, arrogating and ascribing too much to themselves, their power and will, as if they had lives and fortunes in their own hands and at their own dispose, when all depend upon the will of God. I remember the story Jesus told in the Gospels where a man had all of these possessions. He had all these crops and he didn't know what to do with them. He didn't have barns large enough to contain them. Well, you know, you would think the guy would say something like, well, I'll let the poor people come and take what they will. Or I'll bundle all this stuff up and give it away. But no, he's self-centered, self-absorbed. And he says, I'll build bigger barns and then I'll have this stuff stored and I'll have this stuff and I'll take my ease. And Jesus said, you fool, tonight your life will be required of you. John Piper says, when he says, if God wills, we will do this or that, he teaches us that the activities and accomplishments of our lives are in God's hands. God governs what we accomplish. Got it? Not only are our lives in his hands, our success is in his hands. It is arrogant not to believe with your heart and confess with your lips that ultimately God governs how long you live and what you accomplish. Now, this is going to appear, the Lord willing, in the June newsletter, if we get to June. It's an exercise that I do in some of my counseling, and I want you to do it with me right now. So let's do therapy. Ready? Take a blank sheet of paper and write down the middle of the paper, draw a line. And if you don't have one, make it an imaginary sheet of paper. And don't panic, because if the Lord wills, you'll get one in the mail. Line down the center of the page, on the left side, write moral, M-O-R-A-L, moral. And in parentheses, put character. M-O-R-A-L, parentheses, character. On the right side of the page, write the word non-moral. And in parentheses, write these words, skill sets. Skill sets. Accomplishments. Achievements. External features. Talents. Okay, now I know you're done, so let's move on to the next thing. Sometimes a person will come into my office and say, I hate my life. Now, they don't mean I hate myself, because I won't let them say that. They don't hate themselves. They didn't. If they hated themselves, they wouldn't show up for counseling. They love themselves. That's why they're coming for help. But they don't like their life. They hate their life. Various features of their life they hate. I say, okay, this is what I want you to do. Usually I make it an assignment for the next meeting. I want you to go home and make an exhaustive list of all the things you don't like about yourself or you hate about yourself. Are you doing that? Come on. You're not done yet? All right. Then I say, I don't care how trivial it is. If you don't like the fact that you snore, put it on the list. Don't worry about trivia. Put it all down. And when they get back, I say to them, now, what I want you to do is I want you to categorize between the two lists, the left column and the right column, of the things that you don't like about yourself, which go in the left column, moral, character, and which go in the right column, skills, achievements, accomplishments, skill sets, talents, external features. I've yet to see anyone be more concerned about the stuff that's in the left column than they are about the stuff that's in the right column. You follow me? People are more concerned about the stuff over here than they are over here. I'm tall. I don't like the fact that I'm tall. I'm short. I don't like the fact that I'm short. I'm not musically inclined. I'm not mechanically inclined. I'm not athletically inclined. I'm ugly. I have a big nose. I don't like my hair. I don't like blah, 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 blah. You know what they're concerned with? Accomplishments, skill sets, features, achievements, talents, or lack thereof. Are you concerned about this side, character? Yeah. Which side do you think God's concerned with? Which side do you think has to do with providence? You were born short, my friend, because God ordained that you would be born short. Get over it. See, I'm really gentle in my counseling. You got a big nose because God ordained that you would have a big nose. Get over it. Or get surgery, but just, you know. Yeah. You think that's funny, but the plastic surgery industry would go out of business if people got these priorities straight. Now, there are necessary cosmetic kinds of surgery, and then there's just vanity cosmetic surgery. The vanity kind would go out of business if people could get these lists right. God made you with your skill sets, friends. He made you with your lack or ability in terms of athleticism, musical talent. In all other features about your body are ordained by God from eternity past, and that is His providence, and you can't do anything about that. You need to focus your priorities where they belong, where God places the priority, and that's on your character. You see, here's the thing. God's moral will for your life is the same for everybody. His providence is different for everybody. Why are you so interested in being like somebody else when God made you to be you? What you're saying when you're upset about the stuff on the right side of the list, God messed up. You can pray until the cows come home, and God may not lift a finger to help you improve in any area on the right side of the page. But He will move heaven and earth to help you improve in the areas on the left side of the page. And you need to tell your kids this. I've told mine. I don't care if you're an A student or a B student or a C student, as long as you do your best. Because best is about character, not skill sets. Some people are born with 100 IQ, other people are born with 150 IQ, and some people are born with 80 IQ. God doesn't care. He made you that way. Be content with how He made you, but be the best 80 IQ student in the class. Do you understand? Be the best C student. Be the best B student. Be the best A student. Don't be lazy. You see, laziness is a character flaw. Laziness is a moral issue. IQ is not. If you can only run as fast as a 300-pound lineman, then give it all you got. You'll never be a running back. And see, this is so contrary to the way our world talks. You can be whatever you want to be. That's a lie. It's a lie. No child left behind? Tell that to the guy who loses the race every time. So we don't let anyone lose. We make sure everybody gets first place. What we're saying is God's providence messed everything up. And we let people's character go to pot while we make sure their skills and accomplishments excel. Be content with who you are. God has made you with a certain skill set. He's made you with a certain IQ, a body shape, a body height, the body whatever. And that's who you are. Can you improve on it? Yes, about this much. It's true. Should you try to improve on those things? It depends. It depends on where your priorities are. If you're obsessing over it, you need to change your focus onto what God cares about. Now, at the bottom of your list, do this for me. Things on the left, write these words. Change your behavior. That's the solution. See, I'm doing all this group therapy. I won't have anybody to counsel now. So. Maybe this is the way we ought to do this, Doug. Just do it from up here. Change your behavior. At the bottom of the list on the right, change your priorities. You care about something God doesn't care about. You're going to lose every time. You're fighting an uphill battle when you're going to put all your energy and time into changing something God's not interested in changing in you. I want to get on God's team and not waste my efforts. I want to work on the list that God's interested in. And God will get behind me and my prayers will be successful. How many times do you think God will answer this prayer? Lord, make me someone who's honest. Lord, make me handsome. Lord, make me someone who is content with what you've provided and I don't lust and I don't covet. How many times do you think he'll answer that prayer? Every time. Lord, make me famous. Lord, make me someone who loves life in all of its forms. Never guilty in thought or deed of murder. You think you'll answer that prayer? Lord, make me fast. You see how messed up we can become when we get things out of kilter? And it all comes back down to this passage. Lord, if you will. Now we know what he wills on the left side of the page. Do not murder. Do not steal. Do not lie. Do not commit adultery. Love and honor your mother and father. Have no other gods before me. Put me first. Don't take my name in vain. Don't covet, and so on and so forth. We know what he wants. We just need to get to the business of praying about those things and start making some changes in our lives. We have no idea what he wants on that right side of the page. Should you not pray about those things? No, you should. You should pray about those things. But you shouldn't obsess over them. More money is spent obsessing over stuff on the right side of the page than is ever spent on the stuff on the left. If you want to be content, if you want your kids to be content, then teach them to accept who they are in the non-moral categories. But to be the best who they are in the non-moral categories. And then turn all of your focus as a family on who they are in the moral categories. And begin to nurture all of those virtues of character in yourself and in your wife and in your husband and in your children and in all your friends. And When God's calamity comes, when his affliction comes, you know what you'll say? Blessed be the name of the Lord, just like Job. And if you've been working on your character long enough, you'll have the ability to say, blessed be the name of the Lord, when tragedy and calamity and affliction comes. Let's pray. Father, deliver us from self-absorption. Deliver us from narcissistic attention to our own features, skills, talents, accomplishments. Help us to be content with how you have made us. You have given us our abilities and lack thereof. You've given us our skills, our talents. You've given us our looks, our shape. Lord, you didn't make a mistake. But our sin, our own willful disobedience, has corrupted our character. And Lord, we need to pay more attention to our character. And we know that when we pray about our character, that you'll be right behind us, giving us the power and the strength to change. Help us to reframe all of our priorities, Lord, to line up with what you care about most. You told us through your Apostle Paul that we are to set our minds on things above, not on things below, not on things of the earth. You told us through your Son Jesus that we are not to lay up for ourselves treasures on earth, where thieves break in and steal and moth corrupts and rust destroys, but to lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust or thieves can break in and steal. For where a man's treasure is, there will his heart be also. Lord, may our treasure be you. And may our greatest desire be to be transformed into the image of your Son, so that we might radiate the glory of who he is in our character. And then whether you make us famous or not, fast or not, popular or not, beautiful or not, we will be content to be like you. We ask this in the precious name of your Son. Amen.